What I'd like to do in this presentation today, it'll be a little bit more than just what the title suggests. I'll be going through some of the history of nectarless cotton, and then discuss my breeding experience with nectarless, and then specifically talk about this new variety that we have just released. As most of you probably know, nectaries normally occur on the mid-rib of the leaves. I often, in wilder types and even some of my breeding materials, I see nectaries also on those other two veins of the leaf, but this is somewhat unusual. They also occur on the base of the bowl of the fruit, and then on the inside of those cotton bracts. And you can see those on the right shows the nectar coming out of those last, the extra floral nectaries, much better than my picture. The primary role of nectaries is to attract cross-pollinating insects. Subsequently, if we have this cross-pollinating, we get greater diversity. It enhances the likelihood that species will survive in the wild. But as we grow cotton commercially, we do not require bees for cross-pollinating or for diversity. So this is a somewhat of a lost function of the nectaries. Unfortunately, the cotton nectar also attracts some harmful insects, in particular plant bugs. And in North Arkansas, we have both the clouded plant bug, as you see there on the left, and the tarnished plant bug. And you see the nymph, which causes a great deal of problem for us. But fortunately, nectarless traits are available, which allows us to avoid some of this plant bug pressure. If you go back in 1961, James and Vesta Meyer published a paper in the very first issue, or not the first issue, but the first volume of Crop Science on the origin and inheritance of nectarless cotton. They indicated the gene, the trait was derived from Gossypium tomentosum, which is a nectarless tetrapod native to Hawaii. Unfortunately, I didn't get to go to Hawaii to collect this, so I keep thinking that should be something I should have to do. They also indicated the hybrids between Hirsutum and tomentosum produced the nectarless plant, and that Claude Ryan, they quoted as indicating that it's probably would be a very good genetic marker. That was their primary interest in this trait. But then it also might have some role in insect pests. They determined that it was simply inherited by two recessive genes. Bill Meredith probably has done more work on nectarless than anyone else has. A 1973 paper indicated that nectarless was associated with reduced bow rot, fewer tarnished plant bug, and boll worm damage, and that there were no strong deleterious associations with the trait. He, in a 1980 paper, reinforced those findings. Then in 1998, at these meetings, he did a review, and he cited 10 studies where tarnished plant bug and western plant bug were measured in nectarless versus nectaried cottons, and average of 48.8% reduction in populations, those insects in those studies. Most of those indicated there was a reduction in target insect population was greater than the reduction in the natural enemies. There was reductions in both of them. The nectarless lines tend to be earlier, similar in yield, and fiber quality compared to related nectaried lines. John Benedict in 1981 made a report of that response to tarnished plant bug varied among nectarless lines. And I think that report is important because it indicates that just because you do nectarless, that doesn't mean you automatically get tarnished plant bug resistance. There is variation among nectarless lines. A report from Australia suggested that nectarless advantage may disappear in large plantings, and they evaluated plantings from a quarter an acre to 10 acres. But I think a much better study from Mississippi, in a report in 1988, indicated tarnished plant bug reduction. They evaluated 33 Mississippi fields, and these range from 40 to 150 acres. This study was really facilitated by the commercial release of Stonewall 825, which occupied over half the acreage in Arkansas during some of those years. So it was a very popular variety. They found that Turner's plant bug population nectarless was 44% lower in 1981 and 34% in 1982. So they concluded that nectarless cotton can suppress Turner's plant bug populations over large areas of cotton. Meredith then developed and released several nectarless lines. Many of these isolines were used in studying the nectarless trait, and I've listed several that I've used in my program at the University of Arkansas. Zinn in 2018 in a cotton science report indicated that there had been six nectarless cotton varieties had been released, and I talked to him, and he said that information was, he got that information from Bill Meredith. And looking at PVPs, I could only find four with PVPs. Then the MD51N was released without PVP. If anybody knows what the sixth one is, I'd be interested in knowing what that is. So prior to boll weevil eradication and advent of BT cotton, spraying for weevils and worms may have masked much of the benefits of nectarless cotton. Therefore, so far, there with without these or with these in place, the nectarless should be an even greater value in terms of Turner's plant bug. Now, to switch a little bit to my breeding experience with nectarless from 1978, when I began my first breeding program, and through 2007, I'd made 689. Cross combinations, 114 were with nectarless, so 16.5%. Plus, I evaluated 102 lines. Many of those were from Wayne Smith that he left in Arkansas when he went to Texas. I don't know if you intended to do that or not, but anyway, I don't know if you left the good stuff or the bad stuff. He probably took the good stuff with him. Seven of those were nectarless, or seven of those 102 lines are nectarless, come from other breeds. I've listed nine nectarless releases, germplasm lines releases, and the nectarless parent that I've made over these years, and those citations will be in my report. From those crosses with nectarless, I've also released four germplasm lines that are nectarine. In the early part of my program, I crossed with nectarless and did not intentionally select nectarless in early generations. So some of these nectarine lines kind of crept through or sneaked through those selections. So from 78 through 07, nine lines released as what I called improved nectarless lines. And the percentage there made the few nectarless lines coming through that program made me somewhat question the association of nectarless genes to agronomic traits, at least the way I handled them. So what I decided to do is start establishing nectarless in very early generations, so I didn't have to worry about that association. It was basically was nectarless materials coming through. From 2008 through 2018, I've made 270 cross combinations, 68 with nectarless, so 25%. So you can see my interest and work with nectarless has improved over that first years that I've indicated. Several nectarless lines are then still progressing through my program. A 2008 cross led to the development of line that we tested as 0812-87NE, which was released this last year as U8-212NE. Here's the pedigree. This line came from a cross of Arcot 0016, which was germplasm line I released a few years ago, and I give the pedigree of it. And if you look at, I won't go through all that pedigree, but much of it you see it goes to Jack Jones, Bob Bridge, Luther Bird, Green, Manning. There's a lot of other breeders that were involved with these lines that go into this pedigree. The H1330 there is a variety that I released back in the 1990s, became Hart's 1330. The second parent is J. Joe 4141. It was a source of nectarless and came from Jack Jones. Now, as far as performance of UA212NE, you can see over all of our Arkansas locations, it's yielded higher than the checks in all locations and at each location except Kaiser, where it was selected, which tells you something about my selecting ability, I think. Yes. Its lowest yield has been at Kaiser, which is a northeast Arkansas location on clay soil. Judd Hill, Marianna, and Roar are all silt loam soils and span about a 200 miles north-south in the Delta of Arkansas. It was also evaluated in 2016, RBTN, 13 locations from Louisiana to California. It was second highest yielding entry of 28 entries, but it was only 1 pound less, the average overall location, 1 pound less than the highest one, which I assume that was just a rounding error, right? So it was obviously equal to the highest yielding variety. It was significantly higher yield than four of the checks and equal to the fifth check, which was UA222. The yield, what I thought was most impressive is that the yield at each one of the of UA212NE at each one of the locations was equal to the highest yield there, which indicates it has very wide adaptability. As far as yield components, again, I think it's relatively outstanding. The lint fraction is very high, and it has a high lint index, but a relatively low seed index. And what is impressive about that, though, is the very high fibers per seed. Generally, you only find higher fibers per seed. One way you get higher fibers per seed is to have larger seed. This is getting higher fibers per seed on a smaller seed, and that's reflected in that fiber density, which is the estimated number of fibers per unit area of the seed coat. Morphological traits is a semi-smooth and stem with leaf pubescence and stem pubescence, very similar to DP393. Bract trichomes are smoother than either DP393 and the smooth leaf UA48, which with lower bract trichomes, it should clean out and have very good grades, even though it is kind of a semi-smooth or moderate hairy. Nectarless, obviously, as I indicated before, are absence of leaf and fruit. Fiber quality is somewhere between DP393 and UA48, but I think it's probably competitive with most of the adapted varieties. Micronair is relatively low, which again is good for our areas. Host plant resistance is resistant to bacterial blight, tolerant to vertic wilt, which is indicated by our yields at Judd Hill, where verticillium wilt is our strongest. And also I run a test where we thin out the population and evaluate the symptoms. And there it was equal to 393, which generally is very good for us. Tolerance to tarnished plant bugs greater than 393 and UA48 in small plots where we look at discolored anthers, but also Glenn Studebaker has put it in larger plots and it held up. So I think that's encouraging. Now, one final nectarless consideration is now there is concern that honeybees might be adversely affected by the neonicotinoid insecticides. This concern could possibly lead to a banning of the use of these insecticides on flowering cotton. In our area, not being able to use these on flowering cotton would be very devastating for us at this particular time. With not having nectar to attract bees, nectarless cotton should be exempt from any such restriction. So I think this is at least an opportunity. If we go down that road, we have some nectarless options that could be very beneficial to us. Thank you very much.
Do you have any questions for Dr. Fred Borland?
Yes, Roy.
I think you mentioned a little of it. Have there been any exhaustive studies on nectarless impact on beneficials?
Yes. That Mississippi study, they looked at beneficials as well. There was a decrease in beneficials associated with nectarless, but the percentage decrease on beneficial was lower than the percentage on tarnished plant buck and the harmful one. So, yeah, there will be some decrease in your beneficial. Some of the beneficials are wanting some nectar as well.
Fred, that study was before BT cotton, before boll weevil, right?
Yes, exactly. This was in early 1980s, and it was greatly facilitated by the Stoneway 25, which became a very popular variety. And I've been very surprised. One reason I've kept working on nectarless is that I thought with BT cotton and boll weevil eradication, then nectarless was the perfect fit. And then your 09, Delphine 0935, I'm still shocked that it didn't become a very dominant, more dominant. You suggested the later maturity kind of limited where it was grown. So I get surprised a lot in my career. So any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Please give another round of applause for all the speakers in this morning session.